This is among the State Patrol unit that was advancing up the street, scattering the protesters at that point for people to clear the area. And so we walked away. I'm sorry?
You're under arrest.
Okay. Do you mind telling me why I'm under arrest, sir? Why am I under arrest, sir?
I told you before that we are with CNN.
That was CNN correspondent Omar Jimenez being arrested live on air by Minnesota State Police in Minneapolis. Last Friday, Jimenez and his crew were taken into police custody and released that same morning as they reported on the city's protests. Here's Jimenez, who is Black, speaking on CNN later that day about his concerns for his own safety during the arrest.
What is really happening here? And the one thing that gave me a little bit of comfort was that it happened on live TV. Mm-hmm. There's been this, you know, when you talk within the community about, let's just say, what's happened with George Floyd, there's always a discussion that what's happening isn't new, it's being filmed. And that speaks to the power of having something happen on camera, because you can have people speak up for you without you saying anything.
Jimenez isn't the only reporter to be targeted by the police. Dozens of journalists around the country have been arrested and many others injured. According to the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker, there have been more than 190 claims of press freedom violations since last Friday. But for Black journalists like Jimenez, this moment is especially complex, with the weight of having to cover the brutality they're seeing while also being Black in America. We're going to talk about it today. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is Your Takeaway. For more on this, we're joined now by three journalists. Farai Chidea is a journalism program officer at the Ford Foundation and the author of several books, including The Episodic Career. Great to have you on, Farai.
Oh, it's so great to hear your voice, Tanzina.
Karen Atia is the global opinions editor at The Washington Post. Karen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tanzina. Hi, Farai.
Hi, Karen.
And Quincy Walters is a general assignment reporter for WBUR. Quincy, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tanzina.
Farai, lots to get to, so let's start with you. I would love an assessment from your eyes. I keep thinking back to the most recent time in my memory that newsrooms have had to cover something similar to what we're seeing now. I keep thinking about Occupy Wall Street. I think about Ferguson, Missouri. How far has the reporting come since then?
Well, I think that there's always amazing reporters doing amazing work, and this is no exception. What we are seeing is nothing less than a collapse of civil society as we know it. And the fact that reporters, oftentimes reporters of color, are sometimes quite literally in the crosshairs while trying to deliver the news is a sign of that collapse of our social order. But this didn't start yesterday. I keep coming back to the Kerner Commission report, which came out after civil disorders in the late 1960s. And basically, the Kerner Commission report said in part that if the American press were better at serving the needs of Black populations and including Black people in mainstream news, we would not have had as much civil unrest. So we are basically on a time loop. It's like we're in a bad science fiction movie where we were told that we had an assignment, which was to desegregate America's newsrooms and to truly empower people of color as agents of storytelling. And we didn't follow those instructions. So we are reaping a kind of bitter harvest from half a century ago.
A lot of what gets lost often in these conversations and in the coverage, I think, Karen, I'd like to bring you in here, is context. We know that the uprising that we're seeing is really centered around the killing of George Floyd, the killing of Breonna Taylor, and other unarmed Black Americans at the hands of largely white police officers. But is the media, Karen, doing a good job in contextualizing these killings with the long legacy of racism in this country, sort of what Farai was referencing with the Kerner report, but even more broadly, are they doing it?
I mean, you know, I would say that very often the onus or the burden sometimes is on Black journalists. I think I feel like we have to be the ones to carry the memory sometimes that our white colleagues across the spectrum don't always have. Personally, for me, I mean, watching the George Floyd protests and I joined the Post in 2014, and that summer was the summer of Ferguson, and it left a real sort of lasting impression on me to be watching on cable news and seeing colleagues being tear gassed, Wesley Lowery, who was at the Post at the time, being arrested in Ferguson. So, you know, when people are saying, even with George Floyd and the arrests now, and journalists are saying, oh my gosh, this is not America. This is like another country. And I'm like, this just happened 6 years ago, right? And so then to even take it further back, and I'm glad Farai mentioned the Kerner Report after the unrest and the civil disorder in the late 1960s. I mean, we know that it was a dangerous assignment to go into the South to cover civil disorder. Journalists also then were targeted and some injured so badly that they passed away. And so there is a history of these issues over our racial justice, struggling over our sort of racial caste order in this country, being a dangerous press freedom moment in this country. And I feel like I wish we would talk about that more. And I think that is a necessary and yet uncomfortable conversation, given that America, we hold ourselves up to be the beacon of press freedom and freedom of expression.
And that's part of the reason why we wanted to convene this roundtable today, was to really be able to get into so many of those layers. Karen, to your point, we are going to dive into what this means for press freedoms in this country in one of our upcoming segments today. Before we do that, I do want to bring in Quincy, because Quincy, you've actually been reporting on the protests in Boston. And I'm wondering, you know, before you get out there and you really do this reporting, are you prepared in terms of the gear that you have? Like, do you have, I recall reporting on Ferguson and not having the gas masks or really being prepared for what was about to unfold there, but also the psychological and emotional preparation. Did your newsroom kind of talk about that before you went out?
Right. So there was a conversation before I went out to make sure that I would be okay covering it. And it was made clear that if I did not feel okay covering it, that was a-okay. But I felt psychologically prepared to do it. I think, you know, just subconsciously doing this job for the past 5 years, it's kind of on your mind that if things go south, there is the potential for you to, you know, be arrested or detained as a Black person. So before I go out, I make sure I wear as much paraphernalia from my news organization as possible to make it clear. But even so, that's not a guarantee that you'll be protected. But before I went out recently, there have been several conversations with my bosses to make sure that I was okay to go out. And in terms of equipment, I don't have equipment like a gas mask to go out. I mean, I do have a helmet, but no gas mask yet.
That is something I can assure you. I think a lot of newsrooms are going to start preparing themselves for that, given the use of tear gas in a lot of these protests. Quincy, what have you noticed has been the tone so far in the protests that you've been covering between police and the press?
So in my experience, I haven't had any negative interactions with protesters. In fact, yesterday I haven't realized this until yesterday, but, you know, being out there as a Black member of the media, I'm kind of like a magnet to people. They see me as someone they recognize. They see me as someone, you know, they can trust with their message. So yesterday, you know, a gentleman came up to me and said, "Man, you know, I'm out here for our people, and I see you and I love you, and you know, I don't want you to get shot, and that's why I'm out here." You know, it's been sort of an incredibly powerful experience in some ways in covering these protests.
Karen, you are on the opinion and editorial side of the Washington Post, but are you aware of how the Post might be preparing its news, its journalists on the newsroom side to go out and cover these protests?
Of course, you know, the thing we haven't mentioned during this particular time is that we're also dealing with a pandemic. And, you know, what I do know is that there, even before all of this happened with George Floyd, we were given, you know, extra instruction on making sure that we clearly had our press credentials, that we clearly had identifying documents. There was advice in terms of just being overly communicative during this time, because we haven't been personally in the newsroom in, I think we're going on almost 2 months. So I think that adds a layer of complication to be able to even discuss this moment and safeguards. But from what I know and what I'm aware of is that I think we are trying to say, okay, you know, identify yourself, just be overly cautious. But yeah, honestly, I don't think, you know, we were prepared for this. But I will say, you know, to the point about being a Black journalist at this time, and just, again, understanding and realizing that there's a lot of historical distrust of us, meaning the mainstream media, in a lot of communities. And I do think that that is something that those of us who are Black sort of have to assume the responsibility to try to carry those stories. So, and then also to reinterpret that back to our colleagues and to our bosses. So it's a challenge. I won't lie. This is a challenge.
Farai, I want to talk a little bit about language in this mm-hmm. moment. We're seeing words like looting and rioting, and we know that a lot of the protests are actually peaceful. We're also seeing a lot of use of passive voice, particularly when it comes to how George Floyd died and or was killed. And so I'm wondering if you can give us a sense of your analysis of the language that we're seeing in this moment.
Yeah, I mean, thanks, Tanzina. I think that this is really critical. So let me frame all of this in kind of how I became a journalist. Both of my parents worked in media at least for a time in their careers. And my mother actually, you know, ended up dead ending, I'm pretty sure, because she was a Black woman. So I was very familiar with the idea of being faithful as a reader and a watcher of news and a listener to news, but also that it was a very tricky space for African Americans to navigate. And I think that part of it is that we have this unresolved, we meaning journalists, have an unresolved set of questions over what is good journalism. So there's an idea of objectivity, but it really is about, you know, I'm just going to be frank here, what seems reasonable to upper middle class white men? You know, and there have been many times that I have suggested stories that later become huge headlines. And it's like, oh, well, that seems niche, or that seems like a little thing, or that seems whatever. Well, you know, other people's human rights can be a little thing if you don't have to deal with those human rights challenges. Other people's economics can be a little thing if you don't have to live with them. And I think that in addition to a deconstruction of American democracy, we're seeing a deconstruction of the concept of journalistic objectivity. And it's about time. It does not mean that there's not fair journalism, but when what is good to cover is what is good for a certain demographic, then we have a lot of chaos in the information ecosystem. Most Black reporters I know are 0% surprised that this was possible, or even probable, that this moment in time was possible or probable. Many white people were like, what happened? And if we had had integrated newsrooms, I think we would have had a different approach to this era. So when you talk about the passive voice, it's like, you know, George Floyd was killed by, it's like, we don't want to, sometimes as journalists, we struggle to assign agency when there's a construct of society that we're trying to protect. So I could go on and on, but I would ask people to look at the news coverage and really say, through whose eyes am I looking? You know, human beings are all individuals. There is a need for news that is universal, but is it really universal if it doesn't cover important issues that are critical to today? And I really do think this was a question of us not covering the consistent issues, us as the larger journalistic community, and want to be clear, not individuals, not covering the mix of socioeconomic factors and racial aggression, which led to this moment in time.
And I want to, you know, to your point, Farai, that whose eyes are we looking through when we cover the news? Quincy, being a Black journalist on the ground right now, there have been lots of conversations, including Black journalists who are talking about this specific moment in time. And I always go back to a Cord Jefferson piece that I read around the time of Ferguson, where he really talked about the trauma of covering Black death and Black trauma. Quincy, do you feel like that is something that's top of mind for you when you're doing this emotionally? Are your colleagues who also are Black journalists feeling this kind of way right now?
Absolutely. I think, you know, a few weeks ago, I had just, I guess, finished the stages of grief of this new life covering a deadly pandemic. And then, you know, after Ahmaud Arbery, after Breonna Taylor, after George Floyd, I think each and every one of those instances sort of is like a crack in that, you know, acceptance phase of grief, to the point where this sort of grief is like all of the stages all at one time. And, you know, as a journalist, I think I have a natural inclination to kind of try to make sense of what is happening. And then you kind of arrive at this conclusion that it's nearly impossible to sort of make sense of the senseless. And it becomes like I'm immobilized. So, you know, there is this sense of grief as a journalist. But, you know, for me, there's also this sense of obligation and sort of duty to chronicle what is happening. And I think for me, that sense of obligation, that sense of duty, you know, trumps my grief. I'm fortunate to work in a place where, you know, my editors and bosses have told me, if, you know, you're feeling overwhelmed on something and you feel like you can't do it, just let us know, and you can sit it out. Like I said, it's sort of managing grief with also, you know, trying to fulfill my journalistic obligation to bear witness.
Karen, we mentioned earlier you are an editor in the Washington Post opinion and editorial department. So I'd love to get your thoughts on two examples that we saw this week that have gotten lots of attention. Let's start with the Philly Inquirer headline, Buildings Matter. Your thoughts.
See, again, this was fascinating, darkly fascinating on multiple levels. So obviously, this is a play on Black Lives Matter, which has been the sort of umbrella rallying cry and hashtag and sort of organizing mechanism for Black people to say that our human lives should matter. So this sort of co-opting of that is quite cynical. And then I think, you know, just the decision to publish this in this moment right now, when again, we are seeing, you know, people, peaceful protesters, journalists being assaulted. I think the numbers now are 10,000 arrested. And so it just seemed tone deaf. And then lastly, and this is back to the segments we had before, to me, it's a question of language again. Can you be violent against a building? I personally, my judgment would be that I value human life over structures that can be rebuilt, repaired, repainted, power washed.
It almost reminds me a little bit, Karen, about like the phrase that corporations are people.
Exactly.
In some way, right? That has that sort of overtone. But we are, this is a very short segment, so I want to make sure I get your thoughts on another big op-ed brouhaha this week, which was the New York Times, Tom Cotton op-ed, which has essentially caused a little bit of a revolt within the Times. James Bennett, Times editorial page editor, said the Times opinion section owes it to our readers to show them counter arguments, particularly those made by people in a position to set policy. Journalists in the Times are speaking out about this, as they did in the Philly Inquirer about that headline. Karen, we've got about a minute left. Your thoughts on the Cotton op-ed in the New York Times.
The Bennett decision to run the Cotton op-ed in the New York Times. I mean, that explanation that, you know, we publish this so that we could open debate. And, you know, as some people saw my response on Twitter, at least at the time, was then, well, then why are the comments disabled? Where are the reader comments? And the piece had been up for several hours before they allowed comments. I mean, just on its face, like, the mechanism for people to be able to have that debate was not available for hours. So then it just leads to this question of like, what exactly were they trying to achieve with an op-ed that basically called for the military, and I think the exact words were to give a show of overwhelming force to subdue citizens, basically, again, calling for, in my opinion, violence against American civilians. And so I think it puts us at danger, Black staffers, not just Black staffers, all of our allies, journalists. This is where we need to be extremely careful in this moment about the rhetoric that we allow on our pages and on our websites, because we know that we're the ones who are going to pay the price.
That was Karen Attia, the global opinions editor at The Washington Post. And we were also joined by Farai Chidea, journalism program officer at the Ford Foundation and author of several books and the former host of this show, and Quincy Walters, a general assignment reporter for WBUR.